This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. President Obama took executive action earlier this week designed to cut down on gun violence in America. It includes proposals for improved background checks, better communication between law enforcement agencies, more mental health treatment, and safer gun technology. The president says he was compelled to act by routine mass shootings in the United States. But the conversation about guns is more often centered on constitutional rights than public safety. So how effective is the president's order? What does it mean for North Carolina? And will this action change the culture of gun ownership in America? On today's program, we'll explore these and other questions about guns and gun regulations in the U.S. And joining me first is political junkie Ken Rudin. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Frank.
Let me ask you why the president weighs in at this level. I mean, obviously, he has to, after each of these events, he has to say something to the American public. But he's at the end of his presidency, and he takes this stand, this large public stand. Why do you think he does this?
Well, you know, I think basically he feels that he's just seen enough carnage and enough slaughter of innocent people, and he's watched it in this one of his unfulfilled accomplishments in his presidency, that he has not cut down the number of gun deaths and gun acts of gun violence. We saw this, you know, I mean, there's an old axiom in politics that gun control is a losing political issue. And we saw this after the slaughter of 20 first graders in Sandy Hook in 2012. And then so you figure the Senate will take action on it in the following year to do something about it. And it voted down and refused to act on universal a background check. So if the slaughter of children in an elementary school, if the slaughter of black parishioners in South Carolina don't move Congress, then the president felt that it was up to him to do something. He decided he was kind of quiet since that 2013 Senate inaction. But then came Roseburg last October. Then came San Bernardino in December. And given what we're hearing from the Republican presidential candidates on the campaign trail, the president felt that with Congress clearly not going to do anything before his term is out, he felt that executive action is the only way to make it happen.
Well, all of what you said, plus after San Bernardino, you couldn't even get Congress to restrict gun sales to known terrorists in the United States, right? People on the terrorist watch list, terrorists, you can't restrict their gun. So again, the president knows all of this. He issues executive orders. He then holds a town hall meeting. And here's the first question he gets.
What can you say to somebody tonight to convince them that you don't want to take away everybody's guns, that you're not coming for their guns?
All right. So there's the first question. The president knows this. The aides know this. Again, he can take the action. Do you think the president really believes there's any chance to move the debate, to change the debate on or reframe the debate on gun control?
Well, he's certainly hoping so. I mean, certainly I think he wants to make the 2016 presidential election a referendum on the politics of guns. We do know that, for example, Donald Trump is saying, you know, pretty soon you're not going to be able to buy guns. And Chris Christie is calling President Obama a dictator. And, you know, Paul Ryan is talking about not only usurping his constitutional authority, but overturning the Second Amendment. We do know that in the wake of San Bernardino, so many more guns have been purchased, fearing, you know, if you buy the argument that gun confiscation is the next step. More people are buying guns than ever before. So he says, the president says, enough is enough. I'll gladly politicize this issue. I know that 9 out of 10 Americans want increased background checks, universal background checks. And I'll be willing to wage the 2016 election on it. But it's just remarkable that, you know, the differences. And what was remarkable, most remarkable, is that what he suggested in his East Room address on Tuesday, and then again in the town hall meeting, that these are really modest requests he's asking. He's not asking for major overturning of anything. It's just to strengthen the laws. But even that is getting tremendous, you know, blowback from the opposition. So he has a tough battle ahead of him.
Well, let's talk about that battle and the political battle, because we know this gun control debate has become an emotional one. But the question is, has it always been that way? And for that question, I'd like to introduce Kristen Goss. She's a professor of public policy and political science at Duke and the co-author of the book, The Gun Debate, What Everyone Needs to Know. Kristen, welcome to State of Things.
Well, thank you very much.
Tell us about this conversation about gun control. It's embedded, the right to own arms, anyway, is embedded in our Constitution, so it's been with us for a long time. Have we always thought about guns the way we do now?
Well, I think the gun debate has become more polarized politically, like a lot of issues in our society. A lot of the arguments that we're hearing now, though, are not new. So fears of the slippery slope toward gun confiscation, have been evident for decades in American political discourse. But I do think that, what we're seeing now is that the gun issue is dividing more neatly between Republicans and Democrats now, and that may be why we're going to see this as being a more prominent issue, I think, in this political cycle.
We get the impression, listening to the debate, that we're trying to really crack down on guns in ways that we haven't ever. But it's interesting in looking at your book that in many ways, states have been, in history anyway, historically, more tough on gun regulations than we are today. Give us a kind of a rough history of gun control and gun regulation in the U.S.
Yeah, so from the earliest days of the American colonies, there have been gun control laws. So one study conducted by a scholar at SUNY Cortland in New York found that around 1,000 gun laws existed between the early 1600s and, sort of the mid-20th century. Those are state laws, and they included everything from bans on pistols to bans or severe restrictions on carrying guns in public, bans on guns that operate like today's semi-automatic firearms, which are, the common firearms that people possess today, regulations on gun sales, regulations on possession by young people and people of dubious moral character, safe storage requirements. There were a lot of laws, including many that would never reach the political agenda today.
They have reached that. Why do you think things have changed, and what accounts for the way that the debate appears to be reframed? Maybe it hasn't, and you can tell me if you think it's been reframed over time or looked at, considered in a different way than it has been historically. But if so, how and why?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important question, and there's a great book to be written about that. I think I've studied this for 20 years. I don't fundamentally believe that this is really a debate about policy. It may be partly a debate about policy, but I think it's mostly a debate about culture and visions of, what America should be and the role of firearms and individuals and liberty and some of these values. I think advocates have done a very good job, creating sort of a value narrative out of what, may in earlier decades have been, basically a policy debate.
Well, Ken, I wonder it's getting back to the president's decision to weigh in and make this a political issue. And obviously it's going to loom large in the presidential election. Given the course of recent history and the way this has been a difficult issue for Democrats, does this help Hillary or make things even harder for her or Bernie Sanders, should he be nominated?
Well, I think the American people basically know how they feel, as I pointed out earlier, that 9 out of 10 Americans, according to polls, suggest that they want more universal background checks. But the fact also is that many pro-gun enthusiasts or the pro-gun crowd are more of a single issue voter than the gun control people. And I think that, expanding on what Kristen just said, if you go back to 1994, when, the Gingrich Revolution and the Republicans took over Congress and the House for the first time in 40 years, a lot of it was attributed to the assault weapons ban that the first President Clinton, pushed through with the Democrats in 1993. And the Democrats paid the price in 94. Many of the House members and the senators were voted out in 94, partly because of this assault weapons ban. So the Democrats almost have been spooked by this for the last 20 years or so. And so, it's just as every time there's another slaughter, another carnage, Democrats, throw up their hands and say, well, we have no say in the matter. We can't get anything through. And when you had these two pro-gun legislators, Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia, and Pat Toomey, the Republican from Pennsylvania, who have very strong NRA ratings, And they tried to put something through, a year or two ago, figuring their voice would carry weight with the pro-gun community. They failed as well. So if Toomey and Manchin can't get anybody to budge, it's hard to make anything, it's hard to make the case that any president or anybody else will do it, and just let's leave it to the ballot box.
But, Kristen, paradoxically, you said that, in fact, the gun control movement has, in fact, gained some traction over the past few years.
Yeah, that's right. And, the issue, Ken is right. There's been this idea that there are a lot of single-issue voters on the pro-gun side, and that's absolutely true. The pro-gun regulation side has faced some sort of inherent barriers to really organizing and organizing for the long haul. As I said, I've been studying this for 20 years, and, it is clear that the movement has a great deal more capacity and resources and activists now than at any point that I've seen in the past 20 years. And I think one of the really interesting developments on that side, on the pro-regulation side, is the involvement of family members and survivors of some of these mass shootings and other shootings as well. They have reached, a critical mass of, hundreds and hundreds of people who are, taking a very prominent place in the movement, are speaking from a national platform, are in many cases working full-time for gun regulation groups. That has, their victims and survivors have always been involved, in sort of scattered ways, but never at this level of sort of critical mass. And I actually think that's going to make a difference. I mean, we saw that in the president's, White House event on Tuesday. We saw the presence of these people, and they have much easier ways of finding each other and staying connected now with social media and the internet, which obviously just wasn't such an organizing tool 20 years ago.
Well, Ken, we're going to take a break right here, and then we're going to come back, talk more about the politics of gun control and the history of the debate on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about President Obama's executive action on gun violence and how it fits into the conversation about guns and gun regulations in America. Kristen Goss is with me. She's a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University and the co-author of the book, The Gun Debate, What Everyone Needs to Know. Also with us is political junkie Ken Rudin. And Ken, you were just about to say something. Kristen was talking about the fact that the movement itself, the gun control movement, has gained some traction over time, although we've seen very little in terms of result on the Hill.
Well, that's true, absolutely true, that no results on the Hill, and in the absence of congressional action, we're seeing more and more action in the states. We saw the governor of Connecticut not long ago basically pass an edict that bars anyone on the government's no-fly list from purchasing a gun. Congress rejected that order, but the governor of Connecticut passed it. Oregon just passed expanded background checks. It's the sixth state to do that since Sandy Hook. As a matter of fact, there are 18 states now that have expanded background checks, regardless of what Congress is doing. So in addition to, as Kristen said, in addition to gun violence survivors and family members who have suffered tremendous losses, there's also some action in the states, because if Congress won't act, there's some states that will. And, of course, this is under Democratic governors, not Republican governors.
One of the big, obviously, the bulwark in the anti-gun control movement is this question of the slippery slope. It came up last night in the town hall meeting. Let's listen.
There's a long history of that. That's in our DNA. The United States was born suspicious of some distant authority. This notion of a conspiracy out there.
But let me just jump in. Is it fair to call it a conspiracy? I mean, well, there's a lot of people really believe this deeply, that they just don't.
No.
They just don't trust you.
I'm sorry, Cooper. Yes, it is fair to call it a conspiracy. What are you saying? Are you suggesting that the notion that we are creating a plot to take everybody's guns away so that we can impose martial law
is a
conspiracy? Yes, that is a conspiracy. I would hope that you would agree with that. Is that controversial? Except on some websites around the country?
There are certainly a lot of people who just have a fundamental distrust that you do not want to go further and further and further down this road.
Look, I mean, I'm only going to be here for another year. I don't know. When would I have started on this enterprise, right?
Kristen Goss, I want to talk to you about and unpack all of that. Yeah, if you're talking about people planning to do something, organizing themselves in order to achieve an end, they're conspiring. I mean, it's not a paranoid delusion, which is sad that he doesn't understand the difference. But if you can't, I guess my point is, if we can't even agree on the vocabulary, can we even have a rational debate?
Well, can we have a rational debate? That's an interesting question. You know, I think that it's important to sort of separate the kind of high-level activist debate from the kinds of conversations that people have around the dinner table. And, you know, people have earnest and principled disagreements about this issue, but, you know, I think it's a lot less heated among everyday people who, you know, are able to sort of understand that we, in every walk of life, we balance rights and responsibilities. And I wanted to add one thing on the state question. You know, there's a lot going on at the states. There have been a number of laws enacted in both Republican and Democratic regimes at the state level dealing with guns and domestic violence, for example, in recent years, guns and mental health. So, and this is, as you sort of indicated, some of this is by design. So advocates for stricter gun laws have sort of given up on this Congress and are purposely pursuing state strategies. So background checks will be on the ballot in Nevada and I believe in Maine as well in this election cycle. So, you know, we have a federalist system and can make laws at many levels. And, you know, states traditionally have a responsibility for law and order issues. So it's not surprising. But there's a lot going on that I think we miss because everybody's focused on Congress.
You know, Ken, but I want to ask you about that. If there's movement at the state level and not at the national, at the federal level, I mean, those are the same voters, right? Those voters in North Carolina vote in national and state elections. Obviously, North Carolina may be the exception. Does the movement at the state level suggest that this translates, or why does it not translate into more activity in Congress?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, if the lawmakers on Capitol Hill are nervous about blowback from a pro-gun voter, then why don't the state legislators?
Yeah, they worry.
Have the same. Well, that's a good question. But you know, I was just thinking of the comment that President Obama was asked at the town hall meeting, and about conspiracy and a lack of trust. There is a lack of trust, and I don't know if it's fomented, probably is fomented by the Republican presidential candidates, but in the wake of San Bernardino, in the wake of Paris even, there is a fear, there's this fear, this anxiety, this uncertainty out there in the country that the president is not doing what he can do to stop the growth of terrorism. And so when the president in response to San Bernardino says we need more gun laws or strengthening gun laws, among many people, the reaction is, I don't know if I believe him on guns, if I don't trust him on national security. And I think that explains why so many more guns have been purchased since the terror in California. So, I mean, you think that one thing should follow the other, but right now it seems to be a losing battle. And you also don't know, for all this executive actions that the president is suggesting, there will be subsequent court fights. And for all we know, these court fights could last until President Obama leaves office. And then you'll leave the decision, the ultimate decision, to his successor. Hillary Clinton is saying that she would go further than the president. And, of course, the Republicans say that they would beat back all of those executive actions.
I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Ken Rudin, the political junkie. Kristen Goss, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Yeah, and as we mentioned, state laws vary across the country when it comes to gun regulations. North Carolina, for instance, requires county sheriffs to sign off on pistol permits, which must include background checks. So how will things change in North Carolina, and how effective will the president's action be? We'll try to answer those questions with Greg Wallace, a professor at Campbell Law School. He teaches a course on firearms law. Greg, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Chris Herring. Chris is a criminal justice professor and executive director of the Institute for Homeland Security and Workforce Development at North Carolina Central University. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Greg, let me ask you about this. First of all, Congress very quickly, particularly Republicans in Congress, responded to the president's action And I think we should point out, I think we have in the press been saying executive order. It isn't, right? It's executive action. It didn't really rise to the level of executive order. But in any case, I wonder what your take on this is, because they're saying he's trying to erode, it's an assault on our Second Amendment rights. What do you think?
I think Obama mostly created the illusion of taking significant steps to regulate guns. Most of what he proposed simply requires better enforcement of existing laws, not changing those laws in any meaningful way. Now, there's certainly nothing wrong with more effective enforcement. In fact, that's his job. But this does not constitute the executive power grab that some feared, and I do think some Republicans contribute to this illusion by complaining and howling about how his actions exceed his executive authority.
What about the here in North Carolina? I wonder about North Carolina's gun laws as they stand now. Are there what are some of the similarities, and how do we differ from, say, federal regulation?
One of the biggest differences in North Carolina is that North Carolina does require private sales of handguns be subject to background checks through the pistol permit or concealed carry license process. If you're going to sell a handgun in North Carolina to somebody else living in North Carolina, then you either have, the buyer has to have either a pistol permit or a concealed carry license. To get both of those, you have to undergo a background check.
Chris, you have a public safety background. You're a former police chief in South Carolina and North Carolina, right?
That is correct.
And now you're teaching at North Carolina Central. And a big point of contention in this debate is background checks. We're talking about those. As someone with experience in law enforcement, how do you see background checks fitting into this conversation?
Well, I think background checks are clearly needed. The question is to what extent they can go. Mm-hmm. And the resources and the time. So I really don't see how anyone could argue about a background check, especially for those who are legally purchasing the weapons, the guns. Maybe part of the follow-up from that is, okay, now that we see what is in your background, what will prohibit or limit mm-hmm. you from the weapon or the type of weapon that you carry?
Well, Greg, I know you have some thoughts on that.
Yes, the universal background checks, and by universal background checks, I mean including private sales from between people who are not dealers in firearms, are not necessarily going to stop people who are dangerous but have no disqualifying records. For example, the Umpqua college shooter in Oregon was apparently very seriously mentally ill, but he had passed Oregon's strict universal background check law. I think that part of it's going to depend on how President Obama, essentially what he's done is told the ATF to go out and enforce the dealer regulation, which requires people who are selling guns as a commercial enterprise to have a federal firearms license and to perform background checks. The law specifically exempts people from who are simply selling guns as a part of their hobby or transferring a collection from having that. And I think part of the problem here is going to be how aggressively the ATF enforces that law. And it's the current law. There's no change here, but it requires those in business of selling the firearms to have these background checks. It could have a chilling effect on people who are really not required under the law to run those background checks. The other thing I think that a lot of people don't deal with here is the forthcoming rule aimed at Social Security beneficiaries. There's a possibility that that rule will just have to wait and see since it's not been promulgated yet. But that could actually be unconstitutional and violate Second Amendment rights.
Well, let's talk about, I think one of the more interesting factors in this, elements of this debate, is this slippery slope argument, the idea that any kind of gun control, any kind of restriction at all, will lead to the ultimate goal of gun opponents, which is to take away guns from all Americans, the slippery slope. How plausible is that, Greg?
Oh, I think there are several obstacles to that. Number one, the Second Amendment. You would either have to have the Second Amendment nullified by the Supreme Court or repealed. There's also the fact that we have 300 million guns in this country, and taking away all those guns would be taking away a huge number of guns from a huge number of gun owners. But I think that the point that was made in the town hall last night is that people don't trust President Obama or other politicians when they say that they're not coming for your guns. President Obama has held out Australia as a model, where the Australia program was a gun confiscation program. They keep making proposals about that won't work. And so the question is, what's your real agenda? I mean, if the safety of Americans is your real concern, then it would seem like you would have different priorities. There are gun bans that are being proposed right now as we speak. There are pending bills in Congress to ban assault rifles again. And the question about these incremental changes, you know, where are you going with these incremental changes? Everybody agrees that that terrorists and criminals, violent criminals, and the mentally deranged should not have guns. But the big question is how you get to that
point. But I have to say, not everybody agrees. For instance, the United States Congress doesn't agree that terrorists in America shouldn't have guns, because when it was brought to their attention that you cannot restrict guns to people on the terrorist watch list, they immediately fought back and they would not pass legislation restricting it. So I have to say, I don't know what you mean by everybody agrees, except the United States Congress.
Well, the no-fly list contains names of people who are merely suspected of being terrorists, not who are terrorists. These are people who are too dangerous to fly, but not apparently they're too harmless to arrest. And the list is notoriously inaccurate. The ACLU has a pending lawsuit challenging that. And one report said that 77 employees of the Homeland Security Department are on the no-fly list. And there's no really fair process for getting your name off the list.
It's interesting that that same Congress is about to restrict all of the every refugee from Syria. That would be even more notoriously suspect for its vetting of terrorists, non-terrorists, than somebody who's actually been through a process of vetting by the Homeland Security. But I'm going to stop there and ask Chris this question about the slippery slope. And again, whether or not there's some validity to this, some sense that, look, there's an agenda here, and these guys are on their way to a much larger project.
Well, I think it really depends on what perspective you come from. You know, we've already discussed a little bit the political, the national policy, or the public safety, you know, perspective. I really don't use the term the slippery slope, but rather, does it open the door possibly for more? And of course, we know that has happened historically with the Constitution, there with public opinion. You make a change, and then once that change becomes the norm, it does open the door yet for another change based on that norm. But I think we really miss the conversation often leaves where the average American citizen is concerned. You know, so we speak about it from a national perspective and policy perspective, but from a public safety perspective and maybe a police chief or law enforcement or the average person, you know, there's some basic questions. Should a 16-year-old be able to purchase or carry a weapon? And if not 16, what is that age limit? Confirmed mental health, should they be able to purchase and own a weapon? And then what type of mental health issue there as well? Should you be able to carry a weapon in a bar while you're drinking, or other folks are drinking there? Should a college student be able to carry a weapon on campus? This really then becomes the micro level, I think, where many citizens are concerned with, rather than the broad, we know it's necessary, but rather than the broader political or national policy issues.
Greg, do you have some ideas on what might work, what could be effective that would reduce gun violence and be a restriction that would also be legal?
Well, one of the things is that we do have to do a better job with the national instant check system. And President Obama's proposals regarding strengthening the effectiveness of that system deserve wide support. And I think that's a good place to start. Interestingly, the NRA has been advocating for years beefing up the reporting. In fact, the NRA was actually the one that proposed the National Instant Check System as an alternative to waiting lists for purchasing guns. And there is a bill right now in Congress, Senator Cornyn has introduced it with NRA support, that will incentivize states better reporting of these mental health records where people have been judged incompetent. So I think that's a good place to start. And certainly, as President Obama said, aggressively enforcing existing gun laws.
Chris, what about you?
Definitely. When you take a look at the executive actions themselves, you know, I really have not heard a discussion of let's agree that this is feasible. This does make sense. This, you know, this is feasible here. There are many items there. For example, improve incentives for states to share information with the background check system. You know, that makes sense. That's needed. Maybe the discussion really comes more so of how do we evaluate what is efficient and what is effective? Can we put an evaluation method up front? And also a little bit more of evidence-based, as I go back to, based on the offender, based on the crime, based on the victim rather than the broad base.
So whatever we do, let's start measuring the outcomes. If we make any changes at all, measure the outcomes and also take a finer look at who is committing crimes. And if you're trying to predict or keep guns out of the hands of likely perpetrators, then let's find out who they are and get a better picture.
Let's start with the low-hanging fruit, as has been said.
Chris Herring is a criminal justice professor and executive director of the Institute for Homeland Security and Workforce Development at North Carolina Central University. Chris, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And Greg Wallace, a professor at Campbell Law School. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the music of Tokyo Rosenthal. Stay with us on The State of Things.